In the Madison Police Department podcast, we promote safety by providing information on current crime trends in the capital city. In addition, we give listeners a behind-the-badge look at community-based, problem-solving policing done the Madison way. You will hear from passionate MPD subject matter experts, people we like to call guardians. These men and women are dedicated to keeping Madison a great place to live, learn, and play.
Well, greetings and welcome to the Madison Police Department podcast. This is our first go at recording again since COVID shut down production operations earlier this year, and it's great to be back as we have much to talk about. Chief Vic Wall is with us, and we are going to try to provide some insight for you into one of the important topics of the year, we think, one that has gotten a lot of traction here in Madison, and that is the department's response to protest. How are you, Chief?
I'm good, Joel. Glad to be here.
Yeah, well, it's been a while.
It has.
We could have picked about 20 different things to talk about today, but, you know, I think protests have been on people's minds, and, you know, I'm getting old enough that I really have not seen State Street boarded up as it was, and it's not so much anymore, since really the Vietnam War. I was a child at that time, but at Randall School, not too far from the downtown, and I remember coming down with my mom and dad and seeing everything boarded up, but boy, we really have not seen anything to this magnitude really in my lifetime, because I look back at the Vietnam War protests, there were a lot of broken windows, but I don't remember the looting like we saw that took place. Why don't you give us a sense as we take a look back into late May, maybe that first day. We had the first large protest really since George Floyd's death in Minneapolis. I think it was a week or so later. And it really was a day of peaceful protest, and we thought things had gone well.
Well, as you pointed out, the first protest was on the Saturday, I think the 29th of May, a week after George Floyd was killed. And, you know, the day before, the Friday, we had heard about the event from the organizers. And we're talking with them, and they were amenable to working with us. And, you know, we have a long history of working with groups of all sorts of persuasions that want to protest and express their First Amendment positions. And you know, our role is really to facilitate that and do what we can to make sure there's a safe event so people can express their opinions, whatever they might be. And on that Friday, it certainly seemed like things were headed in that direction, and the group was working with us, and it, by all accounts, was going to be a peaceful, quiet protest, and we were prepared to facilitate that. When our folks woke up on Saturday morning, you could sort of see that even the social media face of the event had kind of been hijacked by some other groups, and it had a much more ominous sort of tone to it. And I think at that time it made it more difficult for us to sort of predict what we were going to see in terms of behavior and crowd size, and clearly I think some of that had an impact on how things ultimately unfolded.
I think it might be important too for our listeners to give them some perspective on policing the Madison way when it comes to large events, our special events team set, and how we try to go about our business and protecting the First Amendment, keeping people safe. And really, for a long time, it has worked very, very well. If you could talk a little bit about that, Chief.
Sure. I think, you know, we have, like I said, a long history of, you know, not only First Amendment sort of political expressive events here in Madison, but other events, you know, Mifflin Street, Halloween, now Freak Fest, Rhythm and Booms, you know, Farmers Market, Taste of Madison. I mean, so we have a lot of experience in policing large events and large crowds. And when it comes to First Amendment expression, we have a special events team that has a command structure and group of officers that are specially trained in policing large events. And our method and our focus is really on being non-confrontational, engaging the crowd, working with organizers ahead of time to understand what their plans are, what their hopes are for the event, and doing what we can to facilitate the event, even if it sometimes involves civil disobedience or blocking traffic or things like that. it's still our goal to work with the event organizers and do what we can to make sure that we maintain public safety for everybody, whether it's people involved in the event or not involved in the event.
And I think if we look back to the Act 10 protests, where we had people really gathering in the downtown area on both sides of a very volatile issue, to the tune of 100,000 people at times, we really didn't have any issues at all in dealing with that large of a crowd and a very controversial issue.
No, absolutely. And you can look back over our history, and there have certainly been protests and crowds that have been focused on policing previously and focused on MPD specifically that we've been able to manage peacefully by using this method. If you sort of look out there and read some of the literature about best practices and recommendations and things that police departments should do in terms of how they view crowd management and events and First Amendment expression, it's things that are all second nature to us, things that we've been doing for years. So we're really, I think, ahead of the curve on how we view these activities.
And certainly on that first night of major protest, most people who were peacefully protesting actually left. Our officers had were standing down, so to speak, and we had a group of people who broke off. I think we've estimated maybe 200 to 300 who started looting on State Street. And I think that, you know, that was not something that anyone anticipated.
No, clearly, I think from the tenor, again, of how the event had been planned, there wasn't an indication that was going to follow from it. And clearly, it was a relatively small group, at least in proportion to the original large group that protested. But, you know, once that group moved down from the square area to State Street, we really saw behavior start to escalate pretty quickly with some violence, and then ultimately property damage and looting, and that's what caused us to have to intervene. At the time that happened, our officers were not even present, so it was not an issue of officers escalating a situation or causing some sort of conflict. That group did it all on their own. We weren't even there.
And, you know, the part that becomes controversial, I think, well, there's several parts, actually, but one that has gotten a lot of media interest and play, not just here but across the country, is the use of CS gas or tear gas in trying to control a large, out-of-control crowd. What tools do officers have at their disposal when something like we saw that first night on State Street, what are the tools officers can use to try to defuse that situation and protect property?
So, you know, in almost every instance, it never gets to that. And I think that's because of our philosophy and our perspective and trying to engage groups, work with organizers, even during the course of a protest or a march, you know, engaging people that are present and sort of low-key conversations and just getting to know them and them getting to know you a little bit. And that kind of thing can really reduce the chances of any sort of escalation or conflict happening. That's always our preferred course. And I think before what happened in May and June, you really have to go back to probably 2004, 2005, mm-hmm. and student riots down on State Street over Halloween, before we ever had large crowd situations that deteriorated where we had to intervene and use any kind of force. So I think at the front end, we do everything we can to try to avoid that, and we've been very successful.
So we're talking 15 years ago or so was the last time prior to these protests.
Exactly. And once the behavior of a crowd or individuals in a crowd escalates to a situation where we do have to intervene, it's very tricky because, of course, it's not as simple as a typical police call where you just have a couple officers walk in and deal with a situation. You have a large crowd that creates a lot of safety issues for officers, for the general public, and it's much more difficult because the officers are always going to be outnumbered, and so it really limits our options. And typically the most common option that we use or that any police department across the country would use is some sort of chemical spray or chemical agent. And basically we have two kinds that we use, OC, which is pepper spray, and CS, which people usually refer to as tear gas. Mm-hmm. And those are the two main options. And, you know, other options are just using batons or going hands-on, things that are much more likely to cause injury to parties that are involved. So we definitely try to avoid that when we can.
And so I know because of some of what took place in those early days of protests that you've taken kind of a first in the country step, perhaps, by taking a look at bringing in an outside agency to sort of analyze and take a hard look at how we responded and what we did so that we might improve in the future. Let the listeners know a little bit about that, if you could.
Sure. You know, anyone who's heard me talk before, you know, will hear me say that continuous improvement is one of our core values, and I'm all about us improving and being as effective and professional and as good as we can be in everything we do, and certainly crowd management and crowd control is part of that. And there's an entity called the Quattrone Center for Fair and Impartial Justice. They're affiliated with the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and they do what's called a sentinel event review process, sometimes referred to as a root cause analysis. And basically what they try to do is take events or incidents that happen in the criminal justice system, really do a deep dive and identify factors that led up to undesirable outcomes. So I know in the past things they've done, an example has been wrongful convictions. So they'll take a wrongful conviction and really do a deep dive and identify the factors that led up to that. And it's typically not any intentional bad actor at any point along the process, but it's a combination of small things, usually well-intentioned, that can combine to lead to an undesirable outcome. So here, obviously, you've got 3 days of rioting, you've got injured police officers, you've got extensive property damage, you have, you know, officers being in a position to apply force and use mm-hmm. chemical agents, and so I've asked them to sort of come in and do that process, do a deep dive and see if they can identify areas for improvement and key factors that sort of led to those outcomes, which no one would think were desirable.
And are there other departments in the country doing this, or is this are we really kind of breaking some new ground here?
Well, I'm not familiar with anybody using the Quattrone Center or this particular process to look at these events, the unrest, because obviously we're not the only city that has gone through this. Mm-hmm. There are some agencies that internally do a similar kind of process in various forms, but I think the sort of deeper dive from an outside entity that we'll be going through is a little unique.
And can you give listeners a sense as to what it was like for some of those officers out there in the front lines in terms of what they were facing with some of this crowd? Because I think we kind of get lost in most people are peaceful protesters, and we didn't have issues. And thankfully, in the recent weeks, we haven't had issues, even though we have nearly daily protests. But in those first few days, when the officers were injured, what was happening out there?
Well, I think, you know, when you, the starting point, I think, is once that looting began down on State Street, remember, we were staffed for a peaceful protest, for blocking some traffic and you know, stopping cars. And so we're not staffed up to face a massive level of unrest like that. So part of the problem is it takes time for us to get officers in. We literally put out a call for every available MPD officer to come into work. We were requesting mutual aid, not just from within the county, but literally from across the state, to have any available officers come to assist us. And so I think that should give a little perspective that, you know, we've never done that before. And the notion that, you know, we're going to have MPD officers down there, but we're actually having cops come in from, you know, northern parts of the state to assist us because we need that level of help to quell the unrest, I think gives a little perspective to what mm-hmm. the cops are going through. You know, I think they're out there, they're one, dealing with sort of physical risk because people are throwing rocks, throwing bottles, throwing chairs at the officers, but also, of course, a lot of hostility, and there was a lot of, you know, verbal abuse and harassment directed at the officers, threats, and certainly I think it's probably, you know, one of the most stressful things that any of them have gone through.
And what do you credit with kind of the sea change, what we've seen in the last couple of months, really, where we're still seeing protests. We're still out there working with those who are protesting, keeping them safe, keeping the public safe, but yet we're not seeing that level of violence, nothing close to it anymore.
Well, I think, you know, there's a couple things at play. Certainly, as you mentioned, I think we're, you know, we're 80-plus days now, or we've had almost daily protests to some level, and we have literally, you know, bent over backwards to allow people to express their First Amendment rights, to express their feelings and their positions, and even certainly allowed some peaceful civil disobedience, allowed some traffic blockage, and things that are certainly you know, a nuisance to the rest of the community, but we're trying to allow that. And I think if you look at those first three nights, every night there was some precipitating event caused by a small group in the crowd that escalated things to the looting and to the violence. And fortunately, we haven't seen those precipitating events other than one night since then in later June. But generally, I think as long as the crowd continues, the people that show up to protest are continuing to focus on sort of expressing their opinions and not on property damage or violence, we'll be in good shape.
And I know you're going to have the outside agency come in, take a look, and we'll do an after-action report and all of those things. But even as we sit here today, are there lessons learned that you're already taking a look at in terms of how we police the protests?
Well, I think, you know, certainly as I think back to the first night and as I was watching things unfold, there were things in my own mind where I was, you know, thinking, well, we've got to do this better, or maybe this is something we need to look at. You know, one of the things that was a learning experience, I think, for me certainly and for us as a department is the whole notion of the National Guard. And, you know, it's something you probably read about happening in other cities, you know, such and such city called in the National Guard, and that's all you see. And it all sounds very simple, but in practice, when you actually try to do that, it's a massive undertaking in terms of mechanics, logistics, politics, and that in and of itself is a hugely sort of complex thing to navigate, which I don't think we've ever done here, again, going back to the Vietnam
right.
era, so we're decades removed from that, and it's not something that you know, even as a police chief give a lot of thought to or do any practicing or sort of, you know, training on. So it's that was one lesson learned is to sort of navigate that process. And I'm sure there's other things I have in mind that will be part of the Quatron review process and things that we can certainly take away. But, you know, for me, it's important to recognize that the identifying areas for improvement and opportunities to do things better and to be better prepared in the future shouldn't in any way take away from the dedication and the performance of the cops that were out there. You know, that was a remarkably difficult situation they were in, working long hours, long days on their feet, subject to physical injury, verbal threats, harassment, abuse, you know, risk to their selves and to themselves. And they really performed remarkably. And so certainly, you know, any things we need to improve on rest on my shoulders and not theirs because they did an excellent job.
And so here you sit as the acting chief for a lot of months now, I can't remember how many, and you've come in and things were going fairly well under your stewardship. Then we got hit with COVID, then we got hit with civil unrest, and you're probably steering this police department, helping steer the city through at least one of its darkest periods in history, if you know, I haven't lived through all of it, obviously, and neither have you, but how are you doing, and how have you been able to kind of cope with this? I know this is not a job that you're not seeking the permanent job, and yet you've had to really take command in a time where they've been very difficult.
Well, yeah, it's been almost 11 months, and certainly it feels like a decade's worth of experiences sort of crammed into that 11-month period with probably, you know, a few 4 or 5 months to go yet. But, you know, we have very good people. We have a very good command staff. We have a very good workforce. And, you know, they want to do the right thing and they want to serve the public. and that makes my job a lot easier. You know, it's certainly been a challenge this year, and having had the inopportune timing to, you know, be acting chief during the most challenging time, I guess, has been a challenge. But again, it's also an opportunity, I think, to try to keep the department on track and make sure that we're able to sort of keep moving forward and not lose sight of who we are or what we're trying to do, and keep things in good shape for the next chief.
And I know throughout the course of this, and this is not something that listeners probably hear about, they don't read about, but in the course of all this, we've been inundated with positive responses from many, many people in this community, gifts of food and other things. So what has that meant to you to know that all those people are out there? They're not usually the most vocal, but they support the department and they're doing so in such ways that I think it's been meaningful to the officers.
Yeah, I think it's very helpful to the officers. I think it can be very easy to sort of only hear those loud voices, only hear the sort of the criticism and the unkind things that get shared and communicated, either individually or to the whole department. And when people are willing to take time and go out of their way to demonstrate support, even simple things like sending cards or stopping at district stations or, as you mentioned, you know, donating food or a meal here or there, that goes a long way to help officers recognize that they're appreciated and you know, the community here does support MPD and what we do and recognizes how important we are to the public.
All right. Well, thanks, Chief, for providing a little more in-depth look at the protests and how we're going to learn from how we dealt with these things, and that we're going to have an outside group coming in here, and we can be better in the future. And kudos to those officers who are out there protecting and serving throughout this. I'm Public Information Officer Joel Despain, and you've been listening to the Madison Police Department podcast.